Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Atlantic, the Pacific, the Indian Ocean, they're all ringed by cities and harbors, navies and fishing fleets have long competed for their riches, sent each other's sailors to the briny bottom, and stormed each other's shores. Well, now, thanks to the slow burn of climate change, you need to add a new ocean to your mental map of the world. The Arctic ice is going fast, and the ocean beneath is coming open for business. A handful of nations have waterfront property there. The race is on. This hour on Point, mankind's newest ocean and the rush for riches in the Arctic. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you got your mind around the new map of the world? Do you think the Arctic nations, Russia, Canada, Denmark, Norway, the U.S., should go full steam ahead to exploit the oil, gold, nickel, fish, and more? Is it time to go for the bounty of climate change, what's being laid bare there? Or do we need to hit the pause button on some of this and do it now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. We're going first today to Seattle, where an armada of intrepid kayakers is saying no to Arctic oil drilling. Hundreds of kayakers have been gathering in Seattle during the past couple of weeks to protest Shell's plan to drill for oil in the Arctic. Here they are out in the water on Saturday. Seattle says, Shell, no. Okay. Here's kayaktivist, after being called Mila Prince, homesteader, lives in the San Juan Islands, floating on a bright orange kayak in Elliott Bay off Seattle last Saturday, protesting Shell drilling in the Arctic. She says, she's an interview shot by a citizen journalist here.
Global climate change is the issue of our era. It's something that we should all be concerned about. It's something that we should all be assuring our leaders that we are very determined to not let it pass or not let it get further than it already has.
We're going to look far north to the Arctic, but let's go first to Seattle and Emily Johnston. For the last couple of weeks, the port and waters of Elliott Bay have been the scene of protests against Royal Dutch Shell's plans to park there two drill rigs bound for the Arctic. Kayakers have become kayaktivists, and she's one of those, part of the climate action group 350 Seattle, which has been one of the principal organizers of the Shell No movement. Emily, welcome to On Point. What's happening there today?
Hi, Tom. Today we're sort of catching our breath. It was a very big weekend, as I'm sure you're aware, mm-hmm. not only with the kayak action on Saturday, but also the mass civil disobedience on Monday.
And what exactly is being protested, Emily?
Many things. You know, on the view from 30,000 feet, of course, the main thing is climate change and Arctic drilling. And scientists have told us that any drilling in the Arctic will result in climate catastrophe worldwide. And so the fact that Shell is just pressing ahead with this is really crazy. And
why would any drilling equal climate catastrophe? Unpack that for us.
So they broke it down in an article in the journal Nature in January as to which fossil fuels need to stay in the ground if we want to avoid going beyond 2 degrees Celsius of warming.
Mm-hmm.
The worst actors, you know, what we refer to as extreme energy, things like tar sands and Arctic drilling, they have a bigger impact. And therefore, you know, the worst thing we can be doing right now is to be amping up projects like that, when we're clearly still dependent on fossil fuel, but we need to be moving away from that.
So you can't block all of that from the waters in Seattle, but you're trying to block a piece of it. What?
Well, so there's one issue here is that the Port of Seattle is a public entity. So this is, you know, the citizens of Seattle, in essence, have been made complicit in the support of Arctic drilling, and we're appalled by that. So we're trying to say loud and clear, like, this can't happen, it shouldn't happen anywhere, and we will not allow it to happen here without, you know, sort of shining as bright a light as we can on what a big problem Arctic drilling is.
You're so familiar with it. Remind people what you're talking about, the polar pioneer. What's being blocked, or what's laid out?
So the deal was that in January, the port commissioners, actually the very same week that that article came out, which was quite a juxtaposition, our port commissioners let us know that they had been working on this backroom deal, basically, to host Shell's drilling rigs. So there are two actual drilling rigs. The Polar Pioneer is the bigger of the two. It's a big monster. Then the Noble Discoverer, and then the rest of their fleet as well. They need to, you know, we have excellent port facilities here, and so they want to overwinter here, get work done here, et cetera. Whenever they're not in the Arctic, basically, they want to be here, and we don't want them.
Why don't you have your kayaks on the Potomac? I mean, Washington has given a green light to Arctic drilling. So isn't that where the action is?
Well, it's certainly, you know, the action these days, as far as climate goes, is everywhere. Our, you know, global leaders and national leaders both have failed us. And so, you know, at this moment in time, there's really just tons happening on the ground in terms of people power. And, you know, the sort of powers that be and business as usual are no longer going to work for us. And that includes sort of political business as usual.
Hey, Emily, lots of sympathy there for you. I'm reading here online. But also one of our listeners, Steve in Lexington, South Carolina, says, hey, your kayaks are made out of petroleum. They're plastic. What an irony.
I'm really glad you brought that up because we always either get that or, gosh, how did you get to the protest? Do you have a car?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is we all live in a world that is still dependent on fossil fuels. That doesn't mean we have to accept the expansion of that and the worst aspects of that, you know, the most egregious parts of it. We have to start using our imagination and looking forward, looking towards a green economy. You know, the science is there. The technology is there. All we have to have is the political will and the imagination. And so what we're saying is, like, yeah, for this moment in time, there's no way I can live in the modern world, you know, without using fossil fuels to some degree. But I am, you know, going to stand up and say this is not the way forward.
No thanks to hosting this these huge drilling platforms for the Arctic. Emily Johnston is one of the kayaktivists out in the water in Seattle with Shell No and 350 Seattle. Emily, thanks for joining us for a minute today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Meanwhile, way up north, climate change means a whole lot less ice and people looking at an emerging ocean there. There's still some ice. There's a U.S. Coast Guard polar icebreaker churning through ice in the Arctic, slush and large chunks of ice left in the trail bang up against the hull of the ship. Listen to that sound. People are anticipating that what we're going to see is just a lot of water up there as the planet warms, and people are staking their claims. See, this is back in 2007. We talked about it then, but a team of Russian explorers planted a flag in the seabed more than 2.5 miles below the North Pole. Here's Dana Lewis reporting for Fox News from Moscow.
Two deep-water Russian submarines resurface after a historic and highly controversial 9-hour dive at the North Pole. The research team celebrating the equivalent of what one of the Russians likened to an underwater version of a moon landing. But this was also a Kremlin-backed publicity stunt designed to formally lay claim to half the Arctic seabed, by some estimates 25% of the world's oil and gas reserves.
So what's up there, and who's going for it? You can join us at 800-423-8255. With us right now from British Columbia, Salt Spring Island there, is Michael Byers, professor at the University of British Columbia. He is author of International Law in the Arctic and Who Owns the Arctic? Understanding Sovereignty Disputes in the North. Michael Byers, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So is it all claimed? Is that all settled? These bordering nations, what you've got, Canada, the U.S., Russia, Norway, Denmark, because of Greenland, is it all settled or are there disputes over who owns what up there, what sovereignty is?
Well, the good news is that most of it is settled because of some excellent diplomacy led in large part by the United States during the 1970s and the 1980s, foreseeing that there would be places in the world where resources would come into play, where there would be perhaps interest in going beyond the territorial sea in terms of deep water drilling, and setting out rules in advance. And these rules are found in the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. The United States has not ratified that convention, but every administration since the Reagan administration has accepted those rules as binding on the United States as customary international law. And these rules apply very well in the Arctic, so that more than 99% of the Arctic Ocean seabed is assigned unequivocally to one or another of the Arctic states.
Michael, lay out for us what's got people so up on their toes now. Is it, first of all, baked in the cake that the Arctic ice cap is going to shrink and shrink, that we're going to see an ocean essentially opening up there? And what resources would or will become available as that happens?
Well, the first thing to say is that climate change is more advanced in the Arctic than anywhere else on Earth. I've sailed through the Northwest Passage four times, and on two occasions saw absolutely no sea ice.
Wow.
That, however, was in late summer, early fall. And one has to remember that the Arctic is still totally dark in the winter, total darkness, 24 hours a day. The cold comes back, the ice comes back. The distances are truly enormous. The lack of infrastructure, think of the fact that Shell is having to base its oil drilling platforms in Seattle in order to
thousands
access,
of miles away from the
exactly, project. In order to access the northern coast of Alaska. This is a very dangerous, difficult, expensive region in which to operate. And as I've said, there are rules that apply that are accepted by everyone, including non-Arctic states such as China. So every country automatically has a 12-mile territorial sea in which they have full rights. They also have a 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone in which they have exclusive economic rights for fishing and for seabed resource extraction. And if they can prove that the seabed beyond 200 nautical miles is a so-called natural prolongation of their continental shelf, they can even have rights beyond 200 nautical miles. And these rules are all widely accepted. There's a body of scientists at the United Nations that vets scientific data that's submitted in support of different claims.
And still, we're reading about everybody spying on everybody else up there, and disputed areas still there. I'm looking at some on the map here, overlapping claims, and I want to look at the resources themselves. I'm still marveling at the very idea of you seeing no sea ice up there. I worked on the north coast of Alaska some time back, and deep into the summer, the ice was all the way up with us on the beach. We never lost sight of enormous ice during that summer, now turning into a sea. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the new ocean opening up at the top of the world, the Arctic, and the rush for Arctic riches, resources, as the polar ice cap melts away. Hear the sound of polar bears. This is from a National Geographic documentary. Fighting as they hunt seals in the Arctic. Good luck to them as the ice goes. There's polar bears. Here's humankind coming in, ice breaking. And President Obama giving the commencement address yesterday at the 2015 graduating class of the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, a speech largely about climate change. He talked about the responsibilities of the U.S. and others as the Arctic opens.
The United States is an Arctic nation, and we have a great interest in making sure that the region is peaceful, that its indigenous people and environment are protected, and that its resources are managed responsibly in partnership with other nations.
We've heard Atlantic nation. We've heard a lot about a Pacific nation, the U.S. Now the U.S. is an Arctic nation. Michael Byers is with us, professor at the University of British Columbia, has the chair in Canada in global politics and international law there, paid a lot of attention to who owns the Arctic, one of his books. James Bamford joins us as well right now from Washington, author, investigative reporter. His article, Frozen Assets, was posted last week on foreignpolicy.com. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. James Bamford, welcome back to On Point. It's good to hear from you.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
You describe what you call the new great game afoot in and around and under and over the Arctic. Lots and lots of intense spying. About what for what, James?
Well, as you mentioned, there's a brand new ocean in the United States and Russia and a number of other countries who are very interested in finding out what everybody else is doing there, just like they are in the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean. So you've got the United States and Russia sort of competing with each other for undersea with submarines spying on each other and satellites overhead. Canada is getting drones, and the Russians have drones now up there. So you've got a whole assortment of intelligence techniques up there. The U.S. has a base on Greenland, Thule Air Base, and the Russians, or rather the Canadians, have a eavesdropping base in Alert, which is actually closer to Moscow than it is to much of Canada. So you've got enormous amounts of spying activity that's taking place because nobody knows right now who's going to have what assets up there, especially since three countries now are claiming the North Pole is their own, Russia, Canada, and Denmark.
You described this Norwegian group of scientists last summer heading out deep into the Arctic, 21 tons of supplies and food and equipment, a specially designed hovercraft to get them out there. What were they looking for, and what did they find on the spying front, James?
Well, these were very experienced Arctic explorers that were up there exploring, pretty much taking samplings of the sea bottom and so forth, doing normal scientific research, and they were doing a very unique activity. They were going to be on an ice island for about a year, drifting around a few hundred miles south of the North Pole. And so they're all by themselves on this ice island in the middle of the darkness in October of last year. And all of a sudden, they see some red lights in the distance, and they go to see what these red lights are. And all of a sudden, they notice it's a massive submarine that had just surfaced. And as soon as they got within sort of eyesight of the submarine, the submarine disappeared quickly beneath the ice again. They took a few pictures, and they were able to determine that it was a Russian spy submarine, basically, the Orenburg, which was up there pretty much doing the same thing, spying on what everybody else was doing and also taking samples of the undersea ridge, this huge ridge called the Lomonosov Ridge. And the whole idea here is by showing that you have your continental shelf connects somehow to that ridge, you can show that you can have a certain part of the Arctic that will be exclusively yours. And that includes the North Pole to some degree.
James, what's up there? You describe the ice cap as being seen as the ice cap itself as being seen in a death spiral, kind of uncovering this ocean. You say there's $17 trillion worth of what, James?
Well, natural resources. These natural resources have been hidden up there for eons because they've been covered by this enormous ice cap. And now, as we've heard, the ice cap is melting. And as it melts, it gives the countries, particularly the countries that are bordering the Arctic Ocean, United States, Russia, Canada, Denmark, and Norway, rights to certain undersea resources up there. So this is a scramble to see who can get what in terms of the access to those resources. You're talking about almost, I think, 25% of the remaining fossil fuels, oil and so forth. So there's an enormous opportunity up there for countries who can show, number one, that they have legal rights through the United Nations to that territory, and number two, if they can find a way to get to that material, to those resources.
Michael Byers in British Columbia, I've got the U.S. Geological Survey saying 13% of the world's undiscovered oil, about 90 billion barrels, 30% of natural gas, trillion and a half, 1,600 plus trillion cubic feet. Apart from fossil fuels, we've heard from those who want to keep them in the ground. We'll see about that. But what else is there, Michael? There must be a lot of fish up there. We're running out elsewhere. We're going to fish this one down too. And what other resources are there, Michael?
Well, the important word that you've just mentioned is undiscovered oil and gas reserves. These are not reserves that are verified. These are just guesstimations by the U.S. Geological Survey. And even if the guesstimations are correct, it's only a couple years of global supply. So it's not worth getting too excited about, given as well how remote and expensive accessing these resources would be.
Why is everybody so excited then? Why are all these spies headed up there and submarines and scientists? The U.S. is flying satellites over there, you know, time after time after time. Clearly, Canada's, there's a lot of excitement. Why?
Well, it sells a lot of newspapers and draws a lot of viewers to television shows.
Is that why governments spend millions of dollars?
Take into account how these expenses compare to expenses elsewhere in the world. Consider how relatively unmilitarized the Arctic is compared to, let's say, the South China Sea. Yes, there are submarines in the Arctic. Yes, there are satellites taking images of the Arctic. But the total number of soldiers permanently based in Canada's Arctic, this is 40% of the second largest country on Earth. Total number of permanently deployed soldiers is 200. This is not a substantially militarized area. Yes, there are things that happen there, but it's an incredibly large, remote, dangerous, expensive place. And unlike the South China Sea, all of the countries are actually following the rules. James himself mentioned that the idea here is to establish whether or not there's an extension of the continental shelf to fulfill requirements under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. So yes, it's mostly a good news story rather than a bad news story. And then in terms of potential fisheries, the Arctic countries have already got together and have already decided to apply what's called the precautionary principle from international environmental law and to prohibit their nationals from fishing in the central Arctic Ocean until scientific research can establish whether it's possible to have a sustainable fishery there. Russia just issued a press release 2 days ago saying that it would actually order its nationals not to fish in the central Arctic Ocean. So again, another good news story that contradicts this alarmist conflict narrative that some elements of the media like to portray.
Oil, gas, fisheries, what other resources lie there, Michael Byers?
Well, one of the most important possibilities is the opportunity to reduce shipping times by taking advantage of newly opened shipping routes like the Northwest Passage through Canada's Arctic Islands or through the Northern Sea Route along the north coast of Russia. And we're already seeing more shipping taking place. And one of the imperatives right now is to ensure that ships that go there are properly equipped, that the crews are properly trained, that there's sufficient search and rescue and ice forecasting, weather forecasting. And this is becoming a huge issue for the United States because ships that take these two routes along the northern coast of Canada or the northern coast of Russia invariably pass through the Bering Strait, that 55-mile wide channel between Alaska and the Russian Far East. And the United States and the U.S. Coast Guard is becoming quite concerned that they don't have the kinds of jurisdictional powers in the Bering Strait to provide the right kind of safety.
I'm reading about gold and nickel. Where would those be? Are we talking about sea bottom?
At the moment, we're talking about places like northern Russia on land. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the shipping that's coming through the Northern Sea Route is actually from land-based resources in western Russia going east through the Northern Sea Route to China and to Japan. We're also beginning to see some shipping out of northern Canada going west through the Northwest Passage, carrying resources from places like northern Quebec to places like China. So it's not just international shipping, but it's destinational international shipping coming out of Arctic countries and going to world markets. And again, the real imperative right now is to ensure that this is done safely. And again, there's good news here because just in the last week, the International Maritime Organization based in London has adopted a so-called polar code with rules that will become mandatory and heighten the safety standards that apply.
James Bamford, do you see a global media overselling, a sort of a gold rush competition here? Michael Byers suggests it's all settled.
No, I see quite the opposite. I mean, the Russians have been, they just had an Arctic exercise where they had 38,000 servicemen up there. They're opening 13 new military bases up there. I've been following intelligence for a long time, and this is one of the fastest moving places I've seen in the world in terms of moving military and intelligence activities. The United States has been eavesdropping on Russia for years from Canada and from parts of Greenland, and Russia just built one of the largest listening posts they've ever developed right on the edge of the Arctic to eavesdrop over the Arctic. So there's a lot of activity that's taking place up there in terms of intelligence that hadn't been taking place there before.
We've got Lisa Murkowski, Alaska senator, introducing a bill that would authorize the U.S. Navy to build up to 6 new icebreakers. Looking up that way, concerned that the Russians, she says, have dozens. I don't know. Let's hear from our listeners. Anderson, Prattville, Alabama. Anderson, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is about enforcement. I'm clear on all of the laws regarding the Arctic exploration, but what happens when, and it's inevitable, either a nation or a private actor just violates those rules, like in Seattle, Shell has parked those oil rigs. It's against Seattle's law. They said they're in violation, but they haven't done anything. So what happens when somebody just decides, hey, we're going to put a rig in the Arctic? We know it's against the law, but we don't give a crap.
Michael Byers, how did that work?
Well, one of the things that that I've been pushing for, along with others, is to, among other things, remove the liability caps that apply to Arctic oil drilling, so that if Shell has an accident, it's legally responsible for the full environmental cleanup. This is beginning to happen elsewhere. The liability cap in Canada was raised from $40 million to $1 billion, although $1 billion is still pretty low when you consider that in the Arctic, there is no infrastructure. There is only a very small population. If the oil gets into the ice and if the winter comes in and locks down with total darkness, that a spill would be intergenerational in its consequences. But dealing with issues like this in terms of changing liability caps, requiring that a same season relief well capacity be in place, all these things would essentially internalize the so-called externalities and raise the cost of Arctic resource exploitation to where they really should be, to level the playing field. And I'm mystified by the fact that Shell thinks it can make money on the northern coast of Alaska drilling in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea. I cannot see how they can make money unless they're being subsidized by the U.S. government.
James Bamford, if, as Michael Byers says, all the claims are pretty much settled up there or being worked out systematically, then what's all the rivalry about with all this spying?
Well, there's that area that's beyond the basically these undersea ridges that there's a lot of activity to see who can connect to these ridges. And if you can show the United Nations that you're able to connect your some of your
continental shelf,
pretty much the continental shelf, to these ridges, then there's a lot more of the Arctic that can be divided up.
And are the resources concentrated around these ridges? You mentioned the Lomonosov and more.
Well, that's the ridge that pretty much crosses the Arctic, and the Russians are claiming that they're connected to it, and Denmark claiming it's connected to it, Canada's claiming it's connected to it. They're all claiming that they own the North Pole because of that. So these claims have yet to be made or yet to be settled in the United Nations, but I think that's one of the issues that everybody's waiting for, is to see how these things are going to be divided. The United States isn't really a player in this because it never ratified the Law of the Sea agreement.
Tom, if I could just interject and just point out that collecting scientific data for the purposes of submitting a claim to the United Nations is not spying. It's scientific research. And what James is talking about is totally legitimate. These two or three countries are communicating with each other. And indeed, in the past, both Canada and Denmark have jointly chartered a Russian nuclear-powered icebreaker to help them collect scientific data. So it's remarkably cooperative. There is spying going on in the Arctic, absolutely. But I suspect most of it is of a commercial character. Major corporations trying to find out what kind of technologies are available for offshore oil and gas, for instance.
We're looking far, far north in this hour to get on top of what's going on in the Arctic. Michael Byers, please stand by at the University of British Columbia. James Bamford, author of The Shadow Factory and more. His piece, Frozen Assets, was posted last week in Foreign Policy, foreignpolicy.com. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org, about all these surveillance spying, he says, going on in the Arctic. James Bamford, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Hi, everyone. Tom here. The On Point podcast is sponsored by Audible.com. Here at the show, we interview many book authors, whether they're fiction or nonfiction, bestsellers or lesser-known but equally important titles. We love making you aware. Now, Audible.com is helping make books even more accessible, allowing you to listen to great titles whenever and wherever you want. They offer 180,000 titles, and right now, On Point listeners can get a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. You can get started today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the opening up new ocean at the top of the world in the Arctic and the push for Arctic riches, resources, as the polar ice cap melts away under the influence of climate change. You can look at all this and shake your head. It is a reality that has been created, and nations ringing the Arctic and beyond looking very, very closely at this now. Michael Byers is with us from the University of British Columbia. Environmentalists in Seattle out in their kayaks trying to bottle up a Shell Oil, huge drilling rig there. Greenpeace has gone right into the Arctic already. Activists attempted to scale a Russian oil rig in September of 2013. Russian authorities descended using helicopters and here megaphones in the Arctic. News service AFP in 2013 recorded interviews with Greenpeace activists on their boat, the Arctic Sunrise. Christy Ferguson, identified as a Greenpeace campaigner, explained what the group was doing in the Arctic.
Right now, the Arctic Sunrise is crossing into the Northern Sea Route, despite Russian authorities' attempts to keep us out. We are going to expose and confront dangerous oil drilling in the Russian Arctic National Park. It seems the Russian authorities have something to hide, but we're going there to document and expose it.
Let's hear directly from Greenpeace. With us now from London is Ben Aliff. He's head of Greenpeace's Arctic campaign. He negotiated the release of the so-called Arctic 30 crew members on that ship who were held for 3 months in 2013 by Russia after they protested at a Russian Arctic oil platform owned by Gazprom. Ben Aliff, thank you very much for being with us today. What's your concern as these many nations began to look into the Arctic and its resources?
Hi, Tom. Well, I think, you know, what we're seeing in the Arctic is really a tragedy. The science is telling us very, very clearly that the region is undergoing rapid and fundamental change. The sea ice is in, you know, steep decline. And rather than this being seen as a clarion call to action on climate change, to tackle the root causes of the problem, the root causes of the problem that the Arctic is facing, we're seeing a lot of countries and a lot of big businesses basically seeing the tragedy of the Arctic as a business opportunity, and they're heading further north to drill for oil, gas, to try and exploit fishing, that kind of stuff. So it's like the Arctic is now open for business, and it's all down to the fact that it's being changed fundamentally because of climate change.
Ben, explain what you mean. You've called this a kind of what you say the human race's idiot test. You call it this a defining battle of the planet. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the Arctic represents, is very much the face of climate change. The sea ice is in free fall, it's vanishing before our eyes. It's having a huge effect on the local environment, but also the global climate system. And that really poses a challenge. What is our response to that? Is it to say, okay, let's work together collectively with Arctic nations, with Arctic peoples, to try and protect this special place? Or do we say, let's open it up to companies like Shell to go up and drill and face the consequences of an inevitable spill?
We got Paul writing into us saying, we've just had the news of a ruptured oil pipeline incident on the Santa Barbara coast, not far from the even bigger spill in the channel 50 years ago. So if after all this time, we still cannot trust the oil companies to deal safely with this toxic product in a location that should be easy to manage, how the heck are they ever going to ensure a modicum of safety and responsibility in the exponentially harsher Arctic environment? I'm not optimistic. Michael Byers, oil prices are very low. They may stay that way for a while. Is there going to be an oil rush in the Arctic? Is that what the Shell platforms are about?
Oh, well, again, I'm mystified by the fact that Shell thinks it can make money on the northern coast of Alaska, certainly at current world prices. Maybe Shell is looking ahead 20, 30 years and simply trying to identify reserves. Elsewhere in the Arctic, the situation's a bit different. The northern coast of Norway is ice-free throughout the year, thanks to the warming effect of the Gulf Stream. The Barents Sea along the northwest coast of Russia, also ice-free. And that's where we see most of the drilling that's taking place right now. But again, across most of the Arctic, the total darkness in winter, the continued presence of sea ice through much of the year, the extreme distances, the lack of infrastructure, make this an extraordinarily difficult and expensive place to look for resources. And so I agree that this is an opportunity for countries to get it right, to make sure that the full costs are factored in to all the economic decision making, that the environmental risk is factored in as a cost, that the safety measures are up to standard. And if that is the case, then there will be a strong push on companies like Shell to stay away from the Arctic and to invest that money in alternative sources of energy. That, I think, is the future, to actually level the playing field, to stop subsidizing Arctic resource development, because national governments are excited by the romance, and national publics don't understand and are excited by it also. But there's no race for resources. This is instead an opportunity for rational decision making and to steer the world in the direction of a more sensible energy future.
Oh, you got a cool Canadian rationality. I'm not sure it will rule. Ben, do you see the harshness of the weather plus law keeping a race for resources out of the Arctic?
Well, I think despite the obvious challenges, the technical challenges, the remoteness, the complete inability of the oil industry to adequately clean up a spill in ice, that doesn't seem to have perturbed them unduly. Shell are looking to go back this year, and this, we think, at Greenpeace, could be a recipe for disaster, because if an accident were to happen in the Chukchi Sea towards the end of the drilling window, when the sea ice is starting to encroach again, it would be impossible for Shell to mount the sort of response that we saw after Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, that took a long time anyway. It cost BP billions of dollars. And that kind of spill in the Arctic would be magnified an awful lot, because the ecosystem there is much more fragile. It takes a lot longer to break down oil, but also it's impossible to operate in thick sea ice, in raging storms, months of perpetual darkness. It is the most risky frontier for the oil industry to be venturing into. They're simply not capable of doing that safely. And at the same time, the real perversity of this is that the Arctic is melting because of our thirst for more and more fossil fuels. And that is a cycle that we have to break.
Parisa in New Orleans, Louisiana. Parisa, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am so glad that your guest is verbalizing all this because it seems so absurd to keep running down this line. I mean, the melting of the Arctic ice cap is an ecological disaster, the magnitude of which we cannot fathom yet because there has been no such precedent on Earth in recorded human civilization. And we have people in Congress holding a snowball to prove that global warming is not real, when global warming, in fact, will increase extremes of temperature, make winters colder, summer hotter. And what I worry about is how are we going straight down this line that has led to this disaster, and we're continuing in that direction by talking about exploitation of the Arctic. And my main question is, what will happen to those species that exist nowhere else on Earth? I mean, species like the narwhal. I didn't even know what a narwhal was until recently, and I studied biology. I mean, it is a unicorn. It is like,
yeah,
it is a whale with a horn on it. I mean, there are species that exist nowhere else, and what is going to happen to them? We're going to create a park to protect them? No, we need to stay out of the Arctic. It is unbelievable we're even having this discussion, and that everything that's going on up there is happening. It just speaks to how stupid the human species is.
Parisa, let me pick it up, and I appreciate your call. Michael Byers, what about the wildlife? As the ice recedes in the summer, what about the polar bear, the narwhal? We've seen the walruses sort of piled up like larvae on way too crowded beaches. What happens to those populations, Michael?
Well, certainly in the southern portions of the Arctic, the ecosystem has already been radically overturned, and the impact on the species is dramatic. So the reproductive rate of the polar bear in southern regions is going down because the females are no longer ovulating because they can't build up the fat reserves. So we do see this sort of thing, and obviously the dramatic loss of the ice in an ecosystem that's based upon sea ice, this delicate balance between frozen and unfrozen. You know, I think every single U.S. congressman and woman who doubts the reality and scale of climate change should simply travel to the Arctic, travel to northern Alaska, speak to the Alaskan Eskimos about what's really happening, what the people who live there actually see. Climate change is real. It's terrifying. It's unfolding in the Arctic faster than anywhere else on Earth. But the answer to that is not only in the Arctic, it's worldwide. We need to dramatically dial down our emissions of greenhouse gases. We need to come to an agreement at Paris this fall at the conference of the parties to the UN Convention on Climate Change to dramatically reduce worldwide emissions. The Arctic, as Senator John McCain said roughly a decade ago, is our canary in the coal mine, and the canary is almost dead. But we need to realize that this is ultimately a global crisis, and the solutions need to come globally.
Ben Aliff, we had the President of the United States talking yesterday to the Coast Guard here about how climate change presents a real and present danger to American security, affects how the military defends our country, he said. But the Obama administration has also given a green light to drilling for oil in the Arctic. How do you square those, Ben? Are they squareable?
That is a $60,000 question, Tom, and I don't have the answer. It seems very strange on the face of it that you would have President Obama speaking to the urgent need for tackling climate change whilst having, as you said, just given Shell the green light to head up to the Chukchi and drill this summer. And I think, you know, I would echo the sentiments of the urgent need for global action to help protect the Arctic, because the challenges that the far north faces, I don't think, can be completely solved by Arctic nations themselves. So I think there has to be, you know, urgent action at the Paris climate talks that are coming up at the end of the year to limit the amount of polluting greenhouse gases that countries emit. But also Greenpeace would like to see real action in the Arctic, and we're calling for the creation of an Arctic sanctuary, a protected area at the very, very top of the world in the uninhabited area around the North Pole. And we want to see this created to basically try and protect the Arctic, because it is an incredibly special place, a unique, rich, and little understood place.
Seems a little whoops too late when we've got Michael talking about terrifying change already, a radical overturning of the ecosystem there. But I guess we hang on to what we can. Charles in Normal, Illinois. Charles, you're on the air.
Thank you. Well, it's been interesting listening to all this. Most of what I was going to say has been verbalized. The gentleman from Greenpeace mentioned an idiot test. I think we will fail it. That is a dark view, but and normally I do believe that humanity is decent, but those who are in power are somewhat blind to what's going on, and if they're not, then they're greedy. I will say this, maybe in a couple of hundred years, if there's any of us left, our future generations might learn from our mistakes.
Boy.
I'm sorry that that's a bit of a dark view, but if you really think about what's going on, it's one that if more of us took that view, maybe we could do something about it.
Charles, I appreciate your call. Failing the idiot test, 200-year lessons are maybe on the late side, might they? Not. I mean, I wonder, Michael Byers, if the Obama administration is doing this. You say there's not really a race, but maybe they're thinking, well, if we don't go for it, somebody else will. If Vladimir Putin has it all, that's just more trouble. Isn't there inexorably a kind of competition dynamic that is afoot here?
Well, actually, I think that there is a silver lining in the big dark cloud of climate change and Arctic environmental degradation, and that is that the Arctic countries are managing to cooperate on things like ship safety, on search and rescue. They're working together to prevent unscientific fishing in the central Arctic Ocean. They're applying the precautionary principle on that issue. It's actually a good news story that across this former Cold War front line, the Arctic countries are working together. That does not address all the issues, but it is an important element of good news because all this is happening in a place that is experiencing a very rapid climate change. And we're going to see, I think, very rapid climate change around the world, including in southern regions. And perhaps the Arctic is a window into a future where, as a species, we can still work together across borders and cooperate to address at least some of the issues that we won't collapse into conflict and anarchy.
Do you see cross-Arctic shipping traffic becoming very common? This is an alternative to, I don't know, the Panama Canal, or, I mean, is this just going to be another ocean on the planet for freight and everything else soon?
It's not going to become like any other ocean because in the wintertime, the darkness will always come back and sea ice will reform during those winter months and spring months. And so it will be mostly seasonal traffic. And of course, there are also issues of extreme weather. There are issues to do with remoteness and a relative lack of search and rescue. So it's not going to compete directly with the Suez Canal or the Panama Canal for most shipping. But for shipping that's coming out of northern countries, for instance, out of northern Canada or northern Russia, or for some kinds of traffic, let's say from Seattle to northern Europe, the Northwest Passage, the Northern Sea Route will become more competitive. So yes, there will be an increase in shipping. It will not be a major shipping route. But the question is, you know, will we actually be on top of this in terms of applying strict rules of safety? Will we be able to cooperate in preventing the kind of environmental disaster that Greenpeace is so right to warn us about?
Ben, if we just have a few seconds, are you confident countries are going to hold hands and get it right here?
Well, I think the Arctic countries seem to be more interested in allowing the development of oil and gas resources, for instance. So I think we need to pressure them to take a much more pro-environmental standpoint. Already 7 million people have joined the Greenpeace campaign to help protect the Arctic. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is a movement building. We can see that in Seattle. And people are going to do all they can to protect the Arctic.
Ben Aliff with Greenpeace. He's head of their Arctic campaign, joining us today from London. Thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Michael Byers at the University of British Columbia. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.